off. There had to be a slight change of plans. Simon is here, but had to participate virtually. And so I'm happy that Johan has stepped up to participate today, this earlier slot. And so, so he's from University of Liverpool, and he'll be telling us about reducing the sign problem with complex neural networks.
Yeah, so I'm not Simon Hens, and I'm happy to hear that Simon actually joined now. So greetings to Simon, and I can tell everyone that he really wanted to come here, and he really wanted to give a talk, and we hope very much that he's still going to give a talk on Wednesday. Right now he's ill, and the voice isn't up to his usual standard as a great tenor. I also am not going to talk about the Turing model, but you can see me as an ambassador of Simon's here. So if you want to talk about the Turing model, you can approach me. I'm not that great of an expert as Simon is, but I've worked on the model with him for the last few months, so maybe we can have some decent discussions about this. So you don't miss out on critical phenomena in two dimensions completely. I brought you a little movie for the beginning, which is showing a beer mat shooting apparatus, and it shoots beer mats in a very reproducible fashion, in this case without any spin, and I glued two different movies together here, and you see beautifully that there's a spontaneous symmetry breaking in a classical system, which I find completely fascinating. So also, if you want to talk about beer mats and their flights, feel free to approach me. Back to the quantum world, which we are more used to, and to the quantum criticality buzzword. I've been working mostly on the Hubbard model on the honeycomb lattice. I guess that most of you are familiar with the Hubbard model, and also the honeycomb lattice is more or less self-explanatory, so not going to go into details of this, just going to tell what we did so far to reach the point where all these complex-valued neural networks become interesting. So what we did up to this point were hybrid Monte Carlo simulations of this Hubbard model, where we did some Hubbard-Sartorovich transformations to get continuous fields, which we then could massage with methods stolen from lattice QCD, and turned out to be very efficient. We were the first to break this magical scale of 100 by 100 unit cells, and extracted some different results, for example, on the single particle gap, which then fits some universal scaling function in the finite temperature. You can beautifully collapse all the values onto some single line. And we did all this very thoroughly with very large lattices, thermodynamic limit, continuous time extrapolations, all of that. Got the phase transition with a high precision for various natures of this phase transition, like going from a semi-metal to an insulator, and at the same time with the emerging antiferromagnetic order. No great surprises there, but on another scale. Yes, Fakir? Both. So the calculations we used in the end were without an additional mass term. So the single particle gap that emerges there is completely due to finite temperature or interaction effects. But we also tried some simulations with finite staggered mass in this case, which speed up simulations very much. But in the end, you have one more quantity to extrapolate. So the results we used here were without an additional staggered mass. Does that answer your question? OK. Yeah, so from this, we could then extrapolate, as I said, this nature of the phase transition going from this opening Dirac cone, indicating an insulator phase transition and at the same time an antiferromagnetic order forming. And so this is the stage of the art, what is doable with half filling, so without a sign problem. And just as a very minor motivation in between, yes, please.
The question was, on a square lattice, the smallest u opens a gap.
Yes.
But here you are saying, and that gap is exponentially small in
yes.
u. So here, if it is that kind of an exponentially small gap, you wouldn't see it in the numerics. So my question is this a numerical statement that there is a u critical, or you know, is there analytical control on that statement?
You're in a honeycomb lattice, right? There, small u will not open a gap.
Oh, okay. Because you're saying there's no nesting.
Yeah, there's a Dirac.
There's a Dirac point. Okay.
There is nesting, but there's no density of states.
Because of zero density of states. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I would have gone back to the universal scaling function, but even better if it's resolved now. Yeah, so I just wanted to go through this very quickly because it's not really about this physics I'm going to talk about today. This is more like a broad overview of showing what the simulations are capable of at half filling when we don't have a sign problem. And we're now about to venture in the realm of finite sign problems where everything becomes much more complicated. Yes?
Can I make one more comment? So if you can do 100 square lattices, even with the graphene thing, I think if I'm not mistaken, Fokker, you can correct me, the critical exponents were still controversial for this problem, right? Or at least.
Yeah, they are. So
I'm just wondering if you have looked at it and you have a set of numbers which are.
This could fill a complete talk by itself.
Fair enough.
Yes, we did extract some critical exponents and. Of course, we are absolutely convinced that these are correct and the best and whatever. No, but yes, they are still ambiguous. And
how do they compare with previous smaller lattices?
Okay, I have a backup slide.
Remember, we're going to have a moderated discussion later. So why don't you go ahead? We'll trouble you back later on.
Right. Yeah, so as I said, I can tell you a lot about this, but yeah, it might fill some more time. This, some more motivation. This is still a very recent thing. I knew that you're all familiar with graphene and its great advantages, but there is actually nowadays even the possibility of building computers with all the transistors completely based on graphene or carbon nanotubes. And this computer from 3 years ago, barely 3 years ago, produced a Hello World program. So I think that's pretty nice. And now, as I already announced, we're going to go beyond half filling and see what happens if we have a sign problem. And so the obvious thing to do is putting the phase into the observable and using some reweighting. And this is very well doable as long as the sign problem is mild. Which it usually isn't. So Another approach would be to use some tensor networks, which completely avoid Monte Carlo simulations, which we also have recently been working on. And it appears to work reasonably well for either large systems, if you want to get extensive quantities, or for small systems like the one I'm showing here, which is a 3x4 honeycomb lattice, we can get even far away from half-filling very precise results. The problem we have right now with tensor networks is to get intensive quantities from large lattices. So this is why in this talk I'm going to focus on yet another approach.
Oh, sorry for interrupting. And your mu equal one on the plot that you showed on the previous slide, is that the Van Hoppe filling or the settle point?
This is at finite interaction, which I omitted for simplicity here. So we don't really know any particular details about the filling state. So mu equals one should be large enough that we are close to empty or full in whichever sign you choose. But yeah, it's some non-trivial stage.
But mu equals zero would be the Dirac point of the,
yes,
of the
yes.
non-interaction.
Mu equals zero in this convention is half filling and the nice case. I'm very happy about this audience. It's really interactive now. It's great. So, is there another question? Okay. So this talk now, for the rest of what is going to follow, is focusing on the approach using Lefschetz thimbles and holomorphic flow, which also has been investigated in various publications before. And today I'm going to talk about algorithmic improvements. So it's sadly not yet about physics. It's really about efficiency with algorithmic calculations. And this is based on the bold paper here, which is, of course, as always, a group effort. But I want to emphasize in particular that Marcel Rodekamp, who is a very good PhD student in Jülich, was the leading force in this work. And I guess most of you recognize also some other names on this publication. So back to the Harvard model, which we are going to investigate, and going through it very quickly. We have some repulsive interaction, and we have the chemical potential that actually introduces the sign problem. And now, after we do all these Haber-Sultanovich transformations and so on, which I'm not going into in detail now, what we end up with is some path integral with a Boltzmann weight. And we interpret this Boltzmann as a probability density, which should be positive unless we have the sign problem, which we already talked about a lot, when the action is not real. And yeah, again, back to reweighting. This is the standard approach when we split the action into a real and imaginary part, and absorb the imaginary part in the observable, introducing a clever one by the integral over the real part only. And this ratio is what we are ending up with. And now the idea of this Lefschetz thimbles is that we try to make the reweighting effort that we still have to do as little as possible. So these oscillations that we have to average over as mild as possible. And it has been shown analytically at some point that for every model, there exist some manifolds in the complex plane where if we move our integration of the path integral onto these manifolds, the imaginary part of the action becomes constant, at least piecewise. So, yeah, there are these different thimbles which are touching here at these red critical points, or at, at the 0 points. And on each single thimble, the imaginary part of the action is constant. So if we actually can deform our integration contour onto these manifolds, then the sine problem is at least very much alleviated. And yeah, so the original path integral was with real.
So you say that it's at least alleviated. That's a guess. You don't really know that. Is that, would you agree? Depends on the decomposition.
Yes.
Depends on the thimbles.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
So they could cancel out, and it could be even worse than without the thimbles.
Okay. I agree. Yes. Let me add an in practice, they appear to be at least alleviated. But yes, I agree, Fakir. It's in general, we don't know. In general, it could be worse. Yes. Was the passing about the cube? Okay. Right. A lot of this is empirical, and in the end, the numerical experiments show whether it works out or not. So, as I said, we start out with the integration on the...
Just a comment. So the original proposal was, if I remember right, that somehow using universality or something like that, that you could get all the physics from one thimble. Is that somehow established or not? Parker's question is completely well-defined.
I believe that this is outdated, or that this is in general not the case, that you can't get all the physics from one thimble.
I see. So there are multiple thimbles that do contribute.
Yes.
I see. Cool.
And it's quite complicated in general, because in principle, as Fakir rightly said, you might still have a very, very bad or even worse sine problem if you take all of them into account. And also, if you move on the thimbles themselves, then they are touching and in some points of zero action, which means that you have ergodicity problems. So it's all bad. But some problems are still worse than others. And we try to find some nice manifolds where the sine problem is not too bad. So one of these manifolds is the plane that is shown here in red, which is the so-called tangent plane. And this is the one thing one can always very easily do, even without machine learning or holomorphic flow or whatever, just shift the auxiliary fields by some constant imaginary part so that it is the tangent to the main thimble, and integrate on this tangent plane. And quite often, even by doing that, the sine problem is already not as bad as with vanilla HMC on the real hyperplane. I think I already said most of this. Of course, if we deform the contour continuously, then by Cauchy's theorem, we get the same path integral in the end. And now the question, of course, is how do we deform this contour? And an answer to this is also known in principle analytically. There is this differential equation, and if you solve it, you can flow from the real plane onto the thimbles. The problem is just that doing this for the complete real plane is as hard as solving the sine problem in the first place. It's all NP, it's all very bad. And even if you do it point-wise only for the HMC or any other quantum Monte Carlo algorithm, it's still very expensive because the flow itself needs some differential equation solver, like Runge-Kutta or whatever. And this takes a lot of time. So what we do instead of this is we choose some random points in the real plane, we flow them, and then we use this information, which we achieved by the very expensive flow, and we train a neural network to learn the structure of these thimbles. So we feed in the real part we started with and the outcome, which is on or at least near the thimbles we got from flow, and we hope that the machine is going to learn the structure of these thimbles. And I'm not going to go into the details about machine learning here. We just treat it as a black box. We put stuff in and we get some good stuff out. And in our case, the first version we started out with was we just took the real part and we plugged it into the neural network. We got some shift and we combined the original real part with this shift to get some approximation of the thimbles. And again, because we still can apply reweighting, these shifts don't have to be perfect. It's enough if the sine problem is less than before, or significantly less. So, yeah. What we started out with is, again, this reweighting equation. And in the denominator, we have the so-called statistical power, which allows us to quantify how bad this sine problem actually is by integrating over all the fluctuations and normalizing by the integral over the real part, so that we can essentially use the statistical power as a new partition sum. And of course, the closer the statistical power is to zero, the worse everything gets, because we have still the same observable, but some two numbers very close to zero that we have to divide by each other, so that's bad. And again, we can quantify this, because the effective number of configurations we get from our Monte Carlo sampling is just given by the actual number of configurations multiplied by the statistical power squared. And we know from every Monte Carlo simulation that the statistical error in the end scales as 1 over square root of this effective number of configurations. All right, long story short, we used this shift, we trained some neural networks, we applied it in previous studies to non-bipartite geometries, which also have a sine problem, even without chemical potential. And what we found is, no free lunch, it's still exponentially bad. So the sine problem is expected to be exponentially bad in volume. And what we tuned here is the inverse temperature. So the statistical power goes down exponentially in this inverse temperature beta in all the cases, with vanilla HMC always with these empty symbols, and HMC plus our trained network in with the filled symbols, but the slope is different. So we could actually get the coefficient of this exponential badness down, which I think is a considerable improvement. But still, this was quite an expensive thing. And this is because when we go back to the original problem with transforming a contour and all this Cauchy's theorem problem, we see that we have to plug in a functional determinant of the Jacobian of this transformation into the path integral. And calculating this determinant scales as every determinant calculation usually does, as volume cubed. So.
Just to go back to the previous slide where you're comparing HNC and HNC plus your neural network.
Yeah.
Are both of those using Lefschetz thimbles or only neural network as some?
The just HMC is what we call vanilla is just on the real plane, and in this work we actually use the real plane itself. In the work which I'm going to come to now with complex valued networks, we use the tangent plane, which is considerably better, but still worse than what we got with the neural networks. The HMC plus neural network then is using whatever the network trained, and it is essentially the same, still solving the molecular dynamics, which we use for hybrid Monte Carlo, but then in addition, for every accept-reject step, we move onto the manifolds we learned, and we use this effective action, which integrates the determinant of the Jacobian to do the accept-reject step. And this is a very crucial part because the deformation is, for every manifold we use that is not the tangent plane, something non-trivial. So this determinant will be some number, and we really have to know it precisely to get detailed balance. And this determinant calculation goes as volume cubed. So what to do about it? There's these affine coupling layers, which have been around for not very long, but much longer than this work, at least. And essentially what they do is, instead of taking the complete configuration we started out with and plugging it into the neural network, they split it in half. And one copy is just passed through, and the other copy is combined with the first one to some function and gives the new version of the second part. And this function now can be chosen in a clever way, where we say that this XB here now is element-wise multiplied by some function s of the a half plus some affine offset t of the a part, which means that this yb here depends only trivially on xb, the input. And this means that if we calculate the Jacobian determinant, this is completely trivial because we have an identity here in the left upper part. We have some function, which is irrelevant for us in the lower left part because we have a zero in the right upper part. And in the lower right block, we just copy this diagonal function s here. So the determinant is now simply the product over all the s values. So this is a linear runtime function. And of course, we have a neural network that consists of many layers. So we choose some different partitioning in every layer, and we combine all of them. But this is still no problem for the determinant calculation, because product law, this just all combines into a product of determinants. And it could be so nice. But if you recall what we started out with this shift, the determinant we actually have to calculate is not just the determinant over the neural network, it's determinant over identity plus I times this neural network contribution. And this doesn't factorize. So for some time we thought, yeah, this is just not going to work. It's a very nice idea, but unpractical. And this was the state of the art until, roughly a year ago, when we started with this alternative approach with the complex valued neural networks. And in hindsight, of course, it's very obvious, as these things always tend to be. But back then we had to put quite some effort into this, just replacing the original shift by taking the full neural, the output of the neural network as the full thimble guess. And a thing about complex functions is also for the activation functions of these neural networks, we need some absolute values so the functions are not holomorphic. So we can't use default complex derivatives. This is the so-called Wirtinger derivative over there, which is a bit more tedious to calculate and not implemented in default software. And then again, we of course want to use affine layers for the complex network in order to make this simplification for efficiency's sake. But a priori, it wasn't clear that affine couplings are even good enough to describe the thimbles properly. We hope that it's worth it with the runtime improvement. So these are the benchmark lattices. And as I already said, the sign problem is exponentially bad in size, so we took very, very small sizes. I don't have much time anymore due to some questions, which I'm really grateful for, because then I know that you're listening. But then I'll just go through this quickly, because this is the interesting plot. We have some correlators that we actually calculated with exact diagonalization as the dashed lines, and then HMC on the tangent plane in red and machine-learned HMC in blue. And you see that while the red values are all over the place and everything is red because these are our error bands, but the machine learning values are actually quite decent, at least for enough configurations. And we did the benchmark in runtime, and it gave us exactly the runtime we expected, which is volume squared improvement. The question is now, what next apart from larger lattices? So as I already said before, some geometries have an intrinsic sign problem. For example, buckyballs, which appear in nature. They definitely are worth investigating. And we are doing this right now. There's also the idea about using, once again, different neural networks, but this time not about real to complex numbers, but about the structure of the network application itself. Because in the way we do it right now, it still has some dense parts. So simply the application of the network has volume squared scaling, just a matrix vector multiplication. If we reduce this to some convolutional or sparse neural networks, this might get the runtime of everything together down to linear in volume. And with this, I summarize that we use affine complex-valued neural networks to flow from the real plane to some approximate Lefschetz thimbles where the sign problem is so much reduced that we can actually get some correlators. And this is quite fast, and I'm also exactly on 35 minutes. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we've got a question already.
If you think of absolute CPU time, is it possible to get correlators that you do not get with exact, I mean, that are impossible to get with exact diagonalization?
Yes. So.
So because, I mean, here the error bars seem to be quite large. Can you get these curves for lattice sizes that are beyond those accessible with ET?
Yes. So here, of course, we picked some examples where we wanted to show that normal HMC fails miserably. Mm. In particular, if the chemical potential is not extremely large, but we're relatively close to half filling, we can go relatively large by now. So buckyballs are actually doable at zero chemical potential, but they still have some mild sign problem. And you can't exactly diagonalize buckyballs anymore. And yeah, this is pretty general. So as long as the sign problem is mild enough, we can certainly go beyond exact diagonalization.
Okay, thanks.
When you were talking about other ways to do this, there was one way to attempt, which was to take the chemical potential to be imaginary and try to analytically continue. That won't work here.
I didn't fully understand what you mean.
So if you make the chemical potential imaginary, then there is no sign problem. And
yes,
you could try to calculate and then try to analytically continue the results too. This was something that was used in QCD as far as I know. I don't know whether it works here or not.
To be honest, I don't know whether it works. Probably does. I've never really encountered this type of calculation, so I'm sorry about this. At least it's not really common in the community.
You talked about the shift, constant shift.
Yes.
In the contour. Now, for half filling, there is no shift necessary.
Yes.
Now, how does this shift scale with doping, for example? And is it meaningful to connect this shift with some physical quantity like superconducting order parameter? Because that's a new thing that happens in a doped Hubbard model. So this shift should have some physical content.
Yes. So first of all, it's not completely analytic, and it's
even numerical.
It's, yeah, it's not a very nice function. But so if you look at the charge as a function of the chemical potential, at least at very low temperatures, it goes more or less stepwise with some, call it critical chemical potential, at which another electron is added and then another electron is added. So this is more or less the same way which we have for the offset with a tangent plane. So this shift also moves in these steps and is pretty similar to this charge.
It's not monotonic.
It is monotonic, but the derivative is not monotonic.
Thank you.
I didn't follow one thing that you use for the comparison of the sign problem between the thimbles with the shift and without the shift. You used a Hubbard-Zhitanovich which couples to the density, correct? So it's a complex, purely imaginary Hubbard-Zhitanovich. I mean, there are different ways of formulating these algorithms, you know, right? So you can couple to the spin, to the magnetization, or you can couple to the density. So the question is, so you couple to the density, correct?
Yes.
So if you couple to the spin and you don't do the shift, then you get a much better sign problem. So is a thimble approach even better than this one? I mean, that's the question.
I don't have numerical results for that. It might be, I don't know. It might be that a combination of these things will lead to even better results. Simon is...
Oh, okay. I think you can speak, or maybe not.
Simon, talk to me.
Hello, yeah. Can you hear me, Canada?
Yeah.
Johan, from what I've understood from your talk, there's two components to it. There's the sign problem. You perhaps ameliorate the sign problem by choosing a thimble or finding a thimble. And then there's your machine learning approach for ameliorating the problem of calculating the Jacobian along the thimble. And somehow your results say, yeah, things are better, but I can't work out can you tell where the improvement has come from? Is it because of the thimble, or is it because of the machine learning, or is it some marvelous combination of the two?
Yeah, it's a wild combination. So the improvement, of course, comes from going as close to the thimbles as possible, and everything about machine learning, and in particular using complex valued neural networks, is all about speeding things up. So the actual improvement in, say, physical quantities with the statistical power comes only from the vicinity to the Lefschetz thimbles. Everything else, like the heart of this talk, is just about algorithms and, yeah, speed.
So in 5 years' time, when you give this talk, the neural network aspect will just be taken as read, and we'll be really talking about the thimbles.
I'm not sure I fully understood you.
Well, the neural networks is just another technique for doing. It's just another numerical technique for doing the calculation. The edge is by going close to the thimble as possible.
Yes.
So can you comment on the critical exponents for the Hubbard model on honeycomb lettuce now?
This is maybe not exactly up to date, but like a year old, so should be more or less the recent summary.
Which one is on 100 times 100?
The very top one. So to summarize everything quickly, the values are consistent for the critical coupling. They are completely inconsistent for the critical exponents. And this inconsistency is spread out over a lot of different works. And our work is consistent with some previous ones and incompatible with others. And it's a zoo. It's very, very hard to
see. Is it possible to go from,
for example, can you kind of go to finite, small lattices, extract critical exponents from there to compare with other QMC works on the same lattice sizes. I mean, in principle, I would have expected that if you compare with, say, 16 squared lattice sizes, you should get consistent results among the different QMC.
This is what you should expect, yes. But this is not really what we find. So yeah, of course, many of these methods are not exactly QMC methods, at least the lower half. And with the upper,
that's a different story.
Yeah, yeah. But with the upper half, you have loads of different finite something effects. So you have finite size, you have finite temperature, you have finite time discretization, imaginary time, and you have to do all of these extrapolations. You have different Hubbard-Sutornovich transformations, different discretizations. So it's the comparisons are very hard to really make one-to-one.
Can you do the charge density wave transition with a hybrid Monte Carlo approach?
We can measure the order parameter.
And the exponents?
With the following analysis, yes. Okay. For half filling, there is no charge density wave, but away from half filling, we didn't measure it yet.
Okay, so I have sort of a slightly technical question about your algorithm, and maybe this is something that Fokker referred to. So typically, hybrid Monte Carlo encounters critical slowing down as you set the mass, the staggered mass, to zero. In the sense, since the way I look at it is that your auxiliary field is very highly fluctuating, so there are the Monte Carlo is, or the fermion mass or matrix is very singular. So do you have any comment about that as to what is
going on? If you look at the spectrum of the fermion matrix, depending on the time discretization, this is essentially the main influence at this point. The moment you introduce some staggered mass, of course, you get a lower cutoff, so everything's fine. But without staggered mass, you have the lowest mode of the fermion matrix going like 1 over time step squared. And in order to scale this, no, 1 over number of time steps squared this way. And in order to scale it properly, you have to scale it with the inverse temperature. So the lowest mode of the fermion matrix, which is essentially proportional to the time we need for the solver, goes like 1 over inverse temperature squared. And this means that the algorithm needs beta squared runtime as an additional factor to the volume. This also comes back in physical observables again, because we have a thermal gap. So the single particle gap that we extrapolate has a very significant finite temperature effect.
So
this is in the end the cutoff we get, the scale setting.
So just to understand, although you go to 100 by 100 lattice in your sort of space, you still are only able to go to beta of 12 as the largest thing, and then you extrapolate? How small a temperature beta can you go to?
Then we do data collapse. Yeah, but yes,
so you
extrapolate.
Do all the way to beta of 12 and then extrapolate?
Yes, okay. for these simulations, I think yes.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Johan, again.